Did you change shirts? Is that a different shirt?
Yeah, it's a lot different color too.
Okay, all right. It just
it looks blue, doesn't it?
Looks nice.
I'm Wade Phillips.
And I'm Wes Phillips. We're past and present coaches here to bring you an insider's perspective on the teams, the people, and the personalities that we've encountered over time. This episode, we're going to talk a little bit about what it's like to grow up as a coach's kid. Both of us, obviously, being coach's kids, and a little different background with, you know, my whole life. Dad, you were an NFL football coach, and of course, your dad, as you were growing up, moving through mostly the high school ranks through Texas, and a little bit of college coaching in there as well. I think a good start to this would be just kind of getting to how this whole three generation coaching family kind of started. And, you know, Bum himself, give me if I'm wrong here, but it wasn't exactly Bum's, you know, dream in life is to become a football coach. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. He played football in high school, and then the war came along. So he'd finished high school and the war came along. And of course he wanted to join up as soon as as soon as Pearl Harbor happened. He joined that day. I mean, he went down there to join. So I'm sure he didn't know what he's going to do. And he wasn't thinking about college. I know that, because we'll talk about that later. But he was, he's ready to go fight for his country. He ended up joining in the Marines. He was in line to join the Marines, and one of the tests you had to have was color blindness, and he was colorblind. And so he was in line, but the people in front of him, he was getting the people in front of him to tell him what colors that they were showing in a row, so he could memorize, because he wanted to get in. He didn't want to get rejected. And so he got up to the front of the line. I guess they must have changed it and did it backwards or something. But anyway, he missed every one of them because he was colorblind, you know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he said they passed him anyway because they wanted everybody they could get. And so so it wasn't really important that you pass that. But he tried to get all the people in front of him to help him, but it didn't work out. But anyway, they passed him on that. And then when he joined the Marines, it was a special unit. In fact, President Roosevelt's son was the leader of this Marine division that he was in. But that particular division, you had to be at least 6 foot and at least 200 pounds, which was a pretty good sized man. You know, Daddy was 18 years old then, but pretty good size, especially in those days. They were kind of a elite, a unit that way. But he went over. You know, they sent him to, I believe, Seattle, Washington, to train. Well, he didn't like to practice. He just wanted to go over and fight, you know. He wanted to fight for his country. He didn't want to be practicing. And he said they went on marches and all that stuff to get him ready. And but he was ready to go fight. And then he said the first time they got on the ship to go overseas, because they were in the Pacific, they were going to go fight in the Pacific. Against the Japanese. And so they got on the ship and they were ready to invade an island. And what he didn't realize was this was really a trial. There was no, or they didn't think that there weren't any Japanese on this island. They just wanted to teach them how to exit the ship, you know, get in the pontoon boats, get to the island. And they thought they were going to fight. And so his nature is, let's go get them right now. So the night before, when they were docked, he got a bunch of the guys and said, let's go get them. And so they got on the pontoon boats themselves and basically attack an island where there was nobody there. And they got over there and they couldn't find anybody. They couldn't find any Japanese to fight. So he got court-martialed several times. He ended out a buck private. He moved up because I'm sure he was, you know, good at what he did, and he wanted to fight for the United States. But there was always something like that, you know, he'd move up to private, and then they'd knock him back down to buck private. So, but that was one of the times that happened with him that he talked about. Now, most of the war he didn't talk about, you know.
Right. You know, when he wrote his book before he passed, you know, Cowboy Coach Christian, that was one of my favorite parts, was to be able to hear some of those stories, because like you said, most of those Raiders were wiped out during the war, and you know, survival rate was really low.
They had to disband their battalion. You know, I don't know how many are in a battalion. I do know that he went to Guadalcanal and Bougainville, and they said at Guadalcanal there were 60,000 hit the beach and 15,000 died. So, so he didn't talk about any of that. Now, he did talk about when they took the island again. I think they moved him up and gave him, you know, more stuff that, and he moved him up, gave him, what I want to say, they made him over a certain area. But he said they got caught building a still in the jungle. They built a still and had some alcohol, and so he got kicked back to buck private again. So
do you, you know, you mentioned, you know, kind of some insubordination in there, you know, the court martials and such. Do you think that influenced his coaching style? Just because, you know, as we talked about him, he was the type that, hey, I'd rather you just tell me what to do. You don't have to scream at me to do it. And I think I remember him talking a little bit about just how the military kind of didn't sit with him. Like, hey, I wanted to fight. So just tell me what to do and I'll do it.
You know, and let me do it. Like I said, you know, they didn't want them to go by themselves and go fight. And that's what they did on that one island, you know? So he just wanted to, and he did feel that the superiors said, go get them, but they were on the boat and all the lower military guys were the ones that did the fighting first.
The infantry.
Tip
of the spear.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Obviously he fought for our country and it was a long, hard fight. And he ended up coming back after about 4 years in the Philippines.
Well, you know, you had mentioned him being colorblind. You know, I knew that, but I had never really thought about it in the context of actually fighting a war in the Pacific on these islands, tropical type islands, and being colorblind. I can't imagine that would have been any easier for him, you know, in those combats. But, you know, when he did get back again, he didn't go into coaching right then, right? Is that when he went back to school?
No, well, he didn't go back to school. He went back to Orange, Texas, where he was from, where he grew up. And there are still a whole lot of oil refineries down there. And he got a job working in an oil refinery. And he said all along that's what he would probably still be doing if a few things hadn't happened.
This is close. You had been born at this time,
No, well, he went back to Orange. He got married, and, you know, baby boomers. I'm the baby boomer, you know. Went back to Orange, married my mom, who was from Orange. And he met her through his sister, through my dad's sister. And anyway, they got married, and of course, and he was working, so he was going to work. So he went to work at a refinery.
You know, the refinery is really relevant here, because I do remember, you know, I believe it was the Red Cross, right, at the refinery. They had wanted everyone in the company was kind of mandated to, quote unquote, donate a portion of their check to the Red Cross. And, you know, again, being a little bit insubordinate, Bum said he wasn't going to do that. And, you know, why don't you talk about that?
Yeah, he didn't like the Red Cross during the war. And, you know, they didn't, I guess they made him pay for stuff or something. I don't know, something rubbed him wrong about the Red Cross during the war. He didn't feel like the Red Cross helped him.
I do recall, you know, him telling me at one point that he felt like they had the supplies that soldiers needed at the time, and you know, they either had to pay or they couldn't get them. You know, they were saving them for this or that. And he thought that they should have those things. So
yeah, I think that's what it was. And so therefore, he got back. He's working in a refinery, and the refinery says, okay, everybody gives to the Red Cross here. You know, it's the Red Cross, and we're going to give to the Red Cross, and we have 100% participation every time, you know. And they didn't have with him, and he wasn't going to do it. It was him, you know, the principles. He stood by his principles, and so he went in, and they brought him in and said, look, you know, if you don't give the Red Cross, we're going to have to let you go, because we've always had 100% participation. And he said, I'm not giving to the Red Cross, and you don't have to fire me because I quit. And so he left his job right that day. And so now he was married and didn't have a job, and fell into football. I mean, he had played in high school, and he happened to be driving by Lamar College, which is Lamar University now, but Lamar Junior College then. And it was in the fall, you know, when he was working there and basically quit. Anyway, he was driving by, and his old coach that had coached him in high school was coaching at Lamar Junior College. And he stopped, he saw him, and he stopped, and they were out there practicing. He stopped and he walked out there, you know, and said, hey, coach. And he said, Bum, you know, he said, Bum, what are you doing? You know, he said, well, I'm not doing anything now. And he said, well, you ought to go to college. And he said, well, no, I can't go to college. And he said, his coach told him, he said, yeah, they've got the GI Bill that pays for your college and your room and board for all the veterans. And you can play football. He said, why don't you do that? And of course, he was just married and didn't have anywhere to live and didn't have a job. And he thought, well, okay, I'll do that. And so that's how he ended up going to Lamar, and for 2 years, went to Lamar and played for Lamar Junior College.
And then from there went to Stephen F. Austin.
Right. And Stephen F. Austin, he was a pretty good player, I think. And from junior college, the coach from Stephen F. Austin liked him, offered him a scholarship. And all these guys that had been in the war were 4 years older than everybody. And so, you know, the guys that went into Stephen F. Austin, several of them had been in the war, not directly with my dad, but in the same unit or anything, but had been in the war. So you had a bunch of older guys, you know, 24 years old, coming in with 19-year-old freshmen. And so it was quite a different group there. And that was about the time I was born, when he was at Stephen F. Austin.
24-year-old war veterans,
right,
on your football team.
Yeah, I mean, they were tough guys too.
Yeah, seasoned kind of hard men. So once he was done at Stephen F., what was his path that led him to coaching? He grew up, you know, more of a ranch hand. You know, his dad was a ranch hand, you know, working on ranches, that sort of thing. He was going to work at an oil refinery. How did the coaching come about for him?
Yeah, he knew a coach that knew another coach and said, you know, there's a job in Needleton, Texas, you know, as a coach, because he was going to go back probably to work in the refinery. And he had played football now, so he knew some football a little bit. Anyway, that coach said, hey, they're looking for a coach in Needleton, and it pays a little bit better, or as good as the refinery. And why don't you apply for it? So he went to Needleton, Texas, which, you know, is close to Orange and the area he's from, and they hired him. He was the B team coach his first year. And now there were only three coaches. You know, there was the head coach, and there was the assistant coach, and there was the B team coach. They only had three coaches.
Oh, wow. That's quite a job to do right there. And I'm sure the kids were all playing both sides of the ball, and a lot to take on right there as a young coach.
Yeah, even more so because his first year, when he got through coaching his first year, the head coach left. This was right after the season. The head coach took another job. And for some reason, the school board didn't like the assistant coach that much. And so they had a school board meeting to get a new coach, and they liked Bum. And so they hired, and they didn't interview. They just had the meeting and said, we want Bum as our coach. And they voted for it and said, okay, we'll take it. Now, they didn't talk to him about it. He didn't know anything about it. So they left a note on because my mother and dad were gone somewhere. And he got back that night and he had a note on the door and said, congratulations, you're the new head coach at Needleland High School. Of course, he thought it was a joke, you know. So all of a sudden, his second year from B team coach to head coach of the high school. So he had to get going pretty quick.
Yeah, thrown right into the fire there. Second year of coaching, you're the head ball coach, and spent the next about 5 years at Nederland, and must have had some success there, right? Because the next stop from there was going to be A&M with Coach Bear Bryant. So,
right.
What was it about Bum there at Nederland High School that kind of got him noticed by one of the great coaches in the country?
Yeah, he every year there he won and went in the playoffs, won the district every year, went in the playoffs. The last year he was there, they lost to Garland, Texas, in the state championship game. And actually then the state championship game, they flipped coin to play home and home. Whoever won the coin toss got to play at home. They played the game in Nederland. And I was at the game, you know, I was the little kid, you know, I was the water boy, basically, but I got to be on the sideline with them and things like that. But they played in a driving rainstorm. The officials had to hold onto the ball till the center got it because they were afraid it'd float off. You know, it was raining so hard. I mean, and Garland beat Garland beat Nederland 3-0. Now, how they kicked a field goal in that rainstorm, I'll never know. But they played the state championship game there, and I'm sure there was a big crowd there. I was on the sideline trying to keep out of the rain, which was hard to do that day. But, again, he won so many games that he got noticed. And in Texas, of course, obviously, you know, football is really big. And, you know, they had 8 or 9,000 at the game every week in a small town. They had coaching school every year in Texas, what they call coaching school, where the coaches had a big meeting every year. And he got to be a big part of that. People wanted to come, wanted to talk to him because he had a lot of ideas about football and different things about offense and defense. And of course, he was successful, so they wanted to listen to him. And he was known for having, you know, they have a room at hotels wherever the coaching school was in San Antonio or Houston or Dallas or wherever they had it each year. But he'd have a room and it'd be packed every year. And they'd have a chalkboard in there. They'd chalk in and they'd be talking football. And so he was known for that.
Well, yeah, you guys
to be really well known overall as a high school coach.
All the way up to when you were coaching in San Angelo, I know there were the midnight sessions. I'm sure he was doing that same sort of thing back then where the, you know, just a bunch of guys maybe drinking a beer and getting on chalkboards and talking ball through the night. Do you feel like there's still something like that going on for coaches where they're actually sharing ideas or is there a lot less now where people are worried you're going to kind of steal something from them?
Yeah, probably that was that way all along, but you know, Daddy wasn't that kind of guy. I mean, he was a guy that shared things. He felt like, you know, he could get them to do it better no matter what it was. You know, when I was Buddy Ryan, he didn't want anybody to tell him anything. He said, or they'll be getting your job, you know. So, but in Texas, you know, they still have the San Angelo Clinic, which you spoke at, and I have several times. And it's a big clinic where they have a couple of thousand coaches every year, every summer, that come out there to San Angelo, Texas, and talk football the same way. And they have a midnight session where they just keep talking and get on the chalkboard and just hash things out.
Yeah, I remember my experience there, the old coaches, I think they moved the midnight session up to about 9 p.m.
Yeah, I kid them about that. We used to be at, you know, start at midnight, but the midnight session started at 11 o'clock and then 10 o'clock and then maybe 9 o'clock. So,
yeah. So at this point in Nederland, is this where he puts in the quote unquote, what they were calling at the time, the numbers defense?
Yes. He numbered the defensive players. And, you know, if you know about football or maybe you've heard, you know, 2 technique, 3 technique, 5 technique, 7 technique, he put that in high school to teach the players quicker so they'd know where to line up and know what their assignment was by calling out the numbers. And you could call out different numbers and have different defenses. So different. He came up with that at Nederland.
And when you're saying different fronts, I mean, he's calling, yes. You guys were actually calling out like 31 for a 3 technique and a shade.
Well, it'd be a 30, yeah, it'd be a 35 or 37 or 27 or 15 or,
yeah.
And it's mirrored. You know, if you call out 27, there'd be a 2 and a 7 on one side and 2 and a 7 on the other side. But you could call out 27-37 or 27-35 or 15-26, you know.
Yeah, So you were actually calling out all the techniques at the time. And then it kind of evolved from there.
Yeah.
I don't know if I've ever asked you. I have asked you before. I know that when he was naming all of those, this might be interesting to some coaches. I don't want to lose anyone, but you guys named the head-up alignments. You named kind of the – you know, all the places where you actually were playing guys at that time. Do you know why? You know, you mentioned even 7 technique.
Everybody asks what the 7. I get the same question all the time. Why the 7 technique was inside the tight end? And again, I don't want to lose everybody, but the people that know about these techniques, he numbered hit up techniques 2, 4, 6, guard, tackle, tight end, 2, 4, 6. All right. And then he numbered 1, 3 inside and outside the guard. And there was no inside technique on the tackle. There weren't any defenses that were called that. So the next odd number was a 5. So that's where the 5 technique came in. The next odd number was inside the tight end, which was 7. So that's how 7 got inside of 6. If that makes sense.
And was it still a 9 at that point? I mean, I don't know. As a tight end coach, I don't know if you're going to convince me on this, that it does make sense. But,
well, I mean, you 2, 4, 6, 1, 3, 5, 7, the next number 7, the next number 9.
Well, I mean, by that same logic, I could argue that the inside shade of the tackle should be a 5. Because
that's what I'm saying. But there was no... At the time, there was no
4-eye, 2-eye.
They call it 4-eye now, but there was no defense because people were playing what they called wide tackle 6, 7-diamond. Those were the defense in the old days, and they had no one playing inside the offensive tackle. So they didn't name it anything because they didn't have to have anybody line up there.
Yeah. And really, obviously, he made a name for himself with wins, but it was this numbers defense that really kind of got the attention of Coach Bryan. Is that right? So that he could kind of teach some of that.
Yeah, I mean, he hired my dad because he was a winning coach and, you know, he needed a coach, I think, for recruiting too, obviously, in that area. You know, if you hire the, quote, best high school coach from that area, then, you know, he's going to be able to get more players from that area probably. And I think my dad or Bum had made a name for himself. And so, you know, it seemed like a good hire because he didn't know Coach Bryan. Coach Bryan didn't know him, but I'm sure he'd heard of him. I'm talking about Coach Bryan have heard of Bum. So now the other part too was he also made a name for himself down there because Nederland and Port Neches are right together. There's a railroad track that separates the two places, and all of a sudden you go from Nederland to Port Neches or Port Neches to Nederland. You know, if you don't know, you're in a different town. So they're one of the biggest rivalries. They've been playing for, I believe, 90 years now. And so it's one of the biggest rivalries in Texas, or rated one of the biggest. And so it was a big rivalry every year, and football rivalry I'm talking about. And the thing Bum did there at Nederland was unheard of at the time. he beat Port Neches every year. Now, I say that because Nederland was a 2A school then. Port Neches was a 3A school, which, you know, was a higher classification, had more players. But also, Port Neches won the state championship in 3A twice during that time that he beat them. And he was a 2A school. So they won the state, but they didn't beat Nederland. He made a big name for himself there, because this is going to come back later when we talk about us moving around. But he was known for, you know, not only winning at Nederland, but beating Port Neches.
And so when he did get hired by Coach Bryan at A&M, that was 1957. Right. That was just after, you know, most people know about Coach Bryant's A&M, you know, the Junction Boys, you know, the movie. I do recall Bum thinking that, you know, he watched that movie and, you know, from his experience with Coach Bryan, he thought that he wasn't the biggest fan of the movie. Some of his comments were that, hey, he was hard, but the guys all loved him. Is that your memory?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it was obviously true. Players liked him. He was a taskmaster. And, he was hard on them, but you know, coach, you know, the different kinds of coaches and a lot of really good coaches are tough on players, but they like them. You know, they have that real balance that I think is really important. And Coach Bryant was one of those guys and probably the best at that at the time. And obviously through his career. So yeah, he was tough on them, but he was fair and honest and taught them to work hard and what it meant. And of course he was successful, you know, he helped them win. So that turned out to be pretty important too.
Well, I do remember that Bum said, you know, a great trait of Coach Bryant was, you know, he would have an idea in his head of what he wanted to do. And then he wouldn't just say, this is, you know, to the staff, maybe like, this is what we're going to do. He would bring it up and massage it around to where it felt like someone else's idea. And then he'd say, oh, that's a great idea. I think we ought to do that. You know,
yeah. Kind and of, then everybody was for it. Yeah. He was psychologically, he handled situations really well. My dad said, he said that, Coach Bryant was in his office most of the time, you know, and then out on the field with him, obviously, but he dressed by himself. He wasn't dressing with the other coaches and so forth. And he was almost a bigger than life coach, but he would, you know, every few days or every once in a while, he would come by to a coach and say, hey, I want you to go to lunch with me today. And then that coach would run to all the other coaches and say, hey, Coach Bryant's taking me out to lunch today. I mean, he had a way of making you feel special.
Mm-hmm.
And he did that with the players too. I mean, he didn't take them out to lunch, but I'm saying it's the same thing with the players. He made them all feel special. And that's what I say. You can be hard on people, but if they know you have their back or you're all for them or you make them feel special, they're going to do better. One of the things about Daddy was the first day he was with Coach Bryant. He was excited about, you know, coaching the first time coaching in college, coaching with, you know, Bear Bryant, the great Bear Bryant. Now, nobody called him Bear. Everybody called him Coach Bryant, and his wife called him Paul. I mean, but I never heard anybody call him Bear around him. You know, they always called him Coach Bryant. But anyway, he said Daddy was getting his drills ready for practice. So he went out there early, you know, and he's getting everything ready for his drills because he wants to do perfect, you know, for the first day of practice. And he noticed when he got out there, there weren't any footballs out there. And it was just about time getting ready, and he's waiting around, there's no footballs. And just about time the practice is going to start, and he needs footballs for his drill, obviously. He runs over to Coach Bryant. He says, Coach Bryant. He said, Coach, I don't have any football for my drills. They didn't bring the footballs out. And he said, Coach Bryant looked at him and he said, well, you want me to go get them? And he said, as I was running in to get the footballs, he says, I realized the difference between an assistant coach and a head coach. And so he ran in and got those footballs and got them out in time for practice.
What a great image of, you know, Bear Bryant. Well, you want me to get him? No, sir.
Yeah. And Coach Bryant coached from a tower. And maybe people have heard about it or not, but he could see the whole field. And so he could see all the drills and all offense and defense and everything. He could see it. So he had a big tower out there to watch practices every day. But he also did this. He had a coach, same thing he did with taking coaches to lunch and so forth. He would come to a coach and he'd say, "Hey, I want you to do this drill under my tower. You know, when your individual drill, I want you to be under my tower today." Same thing. The coach said, "Man, I'm doing my drill underneath the tower for Coach Bryant today." So, I mean, that's the way he made you feel, that, you know, it's pretty neat that you were doing that.
So you mentioned the tower, you know, kind of a side note. I'm curious, there's actually a picture of you and I during a training camp practice, your first stint in Denver, where I went up, you actually coached from the tower. I don't know how many times you actually did it. That was the only time, I believe, in your career, if I'm correct, that you actually did that. And maybe took a little criticism for it, just because it's very unorthodox now to be up in a tower during a practice. Do you feel like there was some benefit? Did you get any benefit when you actually?
Yeah, it was the same thing. You could see better up there. You could see all the, you know, you could see all the practice. You could see the, you know, the secondary working and the linebackers and quarterbacks throwing and whatever, you know, and whatever drills. Now, you know, nowadays we video everything and you can go back in and look at it if you want to. But I thought it was a benefit, certainly. Yeah, we were up in that tower. And the only thing bad about it, and you know me, I don't really like heights. So especially with that wind blowing in Colorado.
That is a great point, though, about the filming. You know, I mean, now these days, NFL, I mean, just about every single individual period I do with tight ends is filmed. I mean, and everyone is getting everything filmed. There's cameras everywhere and you've got all that documented. And specifically back then, I'm sure, you know, you miss out on a lot if you're just kind of focusing on one area.
Yeah. I think one thing that people don't realize, and coaches don't realize probably, that Coach Bryant, he filled out the practice schedule, like head coaches do the practice schedule, but he filled out every individual drill that each position did. Mm. He had all the tight end drills, which ones you're going to do in order. And like I say, if he wanted you under the tower, he'd say, "Okay, you're going to be under the tower today on this drill or that one." But I don't know that I've heard of many coaches that have ever, maybe they all did it at one time, I don't know, but he, when he filled out a practice schedule, it wasn't just team drill here and 7-on-7. It was, you know, linebackers, and these are the drills you're doing. Quarterback, these are the drills you're doing. And he would change them up, and he would.
That's amazing.
He would, yeah, it is amazing that he did that.
Now, 1 year bums at Texas A&M. With Coach Bryant, and then Coach Bryant is offered, you know, the head coaching job at Alabama, and actually wanted to bring Bum, but what I had been told was that Bum wanted to be a head coach again, and that Coach Bryant, like it was kind of a loyalty thing where he would only recommend the assistant coach, because, I mean, people wanted coaches from Coach Bryant, and he would only recommend the most senior of the assistant coaches.
Yeah, I don't – that wasn't all of it. He didn't want – Bum didn't want to leave Texas. You know, that was part of it too. I mean, he was a real Texan that way. Part of it, he didn't want to leave. And then, yeah, he wanted to be a head coach again. He loved being an assistant coach, I guess, for – Coach Bryant, it was only 1 year. Now, that 1 year, they had a great football team. And John David Crow was the Heisman Trophy winner. And Charlie Kruger, the offensive lineman, was the Outland Trophy winner. And they went to the Gator Bowl that year. They had a heck of a football team, and that's how Coach Bryant got the Alabama job. But
now you were about 10 years old when they played that Gator Bowl, right? Am I right that you were in the locker room? Or
Oh, yeah. I went to the game. My mother didn't go. That, you know, you could take – coaches could take their wife. Well, my mom didn't go, but she let me go in her place. And so I went to the game, and if you look at my book, the you know, Son of Bum, you'll see a picture in there. And I had a picture taken with my dad and Coach Bryant. And I had a little golf-looking I don't know what you call that hat. What do you call that hat?
A Kangol hat? A Bruce Arians hat?
Yeah. Yeah, like Bruce Arians wears or the
golfers. Like
Anyway, I had a little hat on like that, which was, you know, but I was a little kid. I was, you know, I was in the fourth grade. Coach Bryant not only noticed that, he always remembered that. And so, yeah, I went to the game, and I got to be in the locker room before the game. And I heard one of the greatest speeches I've ever heard from a football coach in that game.
This is pregame?
Yes, in the pregame, before they went out on the field from the Gator Bowl. Coach Bryant was bigger than life to me anyway. And like I said, John David Crow and Charlie Krueger and all these guys, you know, I knew all the players, and, you know, they were great players. And, you know, I looked up to all of them, you know, and how great they were. And anyway, in the pregame talk in the dressing room, Coach Bryant started talking, and he said, you know what they say? He said, they say, Charlie Krueger, all you're thinking about is pro football. You're not worried about this game. And he said, you know what they say? They say, John David Crow, you're just thinking about the Heisman Trophy. You're not thinking about Texas A&M and going out and play this game today. And he went right down the line with all the really star players. You know, and he kept saying, you know what they say? And at the end of it, after he really, you know, just almost berated everybody from what they said, he said, you know who they are? He said, me. And I mean, I got goosebumps, and the players just went crazy. I mean, they almost knocked the door down going out. I mean, it was just, you know, Coach Bryant had told them that they weren't ready to play is what he was telling them. It was pretty moving. I've never heard anybody, and I've been around a lot of great coaches, but I never heard anybody say something like that, especially what he, you know, what kind of guy he was, and everybody, you know, felt like he hung the moon, which he did. For him to say they, and that's me. And boy, it was something.
Yeah, only certain type of guy with enough skins on the wall can even attempt a speech like that.
Yeah. But anyway, every time I saw Coach Bryant, because I, even when I got into pro football, I would visit Alabama and look at their players and stuff. And Coach Bryant would say, Wade, come on in here, you know, and he'd be in his office. I'd go in his office and say, you know, I remember you when you had that little hat on, you know, and, you know, and this was 1990s, you know, and that was in 1957. I mean, and the other coaches there would always kid me, because when I came in, they'd say, oh, no, you're here, you know, and I said, what? And they say, we got to hear that little story about you being, I said, Coach Bryant, in our meeting room every time you come, he tells us that little story about you wearing that little hat. So so he always remembered that. And the other thing he did was he offered me a scholarship coming out of high school, sight unseen, to Alabama. I didn't visit Alabama or anything like that, but he talked to my dad and said, hey, I know Wade's playing football and he's a senior. And he didn't know how good I was or not good, but he said he's got a scholarship to Alabama if he wants it.
Wow, that's great. I think that's a That's a great great time to wrap it up for today. Some great stories. We didn't get through much, but a lot of great stuff came up just in a short stint of Bum's career.
Yeah, we got more to go though. We got some more for you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Next time.